Friday's lecture. So what we are trying to do is that we are trying to formulate the Einstein field equations for our classical field theory for gravity. And in order to do that, together with Einstein, we need to understand a little bit of differential geometry. But I am doing that from a point of view of a physicist. So the things which I'm doing here are not really mathematically precise, but they give you some intuition as to how these things actually work. And then, of course, our aim is to understand what tensors are, how to do differential calculus with tensors, and how to formulate these field equations. Okay. So the basic object, the stage where everything is happening, is the manifold. Of course, it will be the spacetime for us. And here is the mathematical definition. So you'll be considering n-dimensional manifolds. So n-dimensional manifold. And n-dimensional manifold locally looks like r to the n. So more precisely, what it means is that if you are looking at the definition, so a manifold is a set of points. And together with this collection of subsets over alpha, such that if I take any point on the manifold, there will always be a corresponding subset of alpha, which actually, for some alpha, which contains this point. Okay? So what it means is that, you know, these subsets of alpha, they really cover the whole manifold. So it cannot happen that I would have a point which doesn't belong to this subset here. Then, for each subset of alpha, there is a map, psi alpha, which maps this open subset to an open subset of r to the n. Okay, and this map is nice. It's 1-to-1 and onto. And so it's a nice map. And so finally, if it happens, so of course, what this map really is, it's like a coordinate system. So I'm choosing some coordinate system on my manifold, which I would call them. I have some coordinates x here, and the psi is the corresponding map to my r to the n. So now if you change the coordinate system, but the point p still belongs to this coordinate system, so then I have another subset o beta and the corresponding map to another r to the n. And so I would have coordinates x prime here. Then the statement is, whatever the map which maps one r to the n to another r to the n has to be a nice map, so it has to be infinitely differentiable. Okay, and so once you have the collections of these maps, and you know, once you know that you can differentiate as many times as you want, you can actually do the calculus on manifolds, and basically everything translates to whatever you know from your multidimensional calculus. How to do, you know, from r to the n to r to the n. Are there any questions to the definition of the manifold? Okay, so that's the definition. So that's the stage where everything is happening. That's the space-time. Of course, in order this to be a space-time, we have to equip the manifold with some additional tensor, namely the metric. But you know, what is really funny about general relativity, as we will see it later on, is that really it's the basic assumption of relativity that your space-time looks like a manifold. So looks like a very smooth thing, and you know, which satisfies all these properties here. So now, as we shall see, actually the Einstein equations predict solutions which break this structure. So you can actually find solutions where you lose this r to the n neighborhood of some points. And so those points are called singularities and whatever. But this, you know, differentiable structure and the fact that it looks like r to the n around it actually breaks down. So in some sense, general relativity predicts its own doom because it says, I have to start with the manifold. But once I actually, you know, probe the manifold a little bit better, I see that it's actually not a manifold. Okay, and so that, of course, is a problem of the theory. But it only happens in the extreme cases. But it tells you that general relativity is not the final word about gravity, because it actually breaks the basic postulate. Very good. So now part B, let us discuss tensors. And of course, so we can equip our manifold with some additional objects, and these objects sort of can live on the manifold. And you already know one of them, and the simplest tensor is the scalar, which we discussed yesterday. And so scalar function S is simply a map which goes from manifold to real numbers. And so if I have my manifold here, and I have a point P here, then the function F will simply assign to this point some number, some real number here. So now, again, how you basically do it is that you use your local subset, you use your coordinate chart. And so this point P, again, that is a corresponding map psi to R to the n. And then I have coordinates x here. Okay. And so if it happens that I have another coordinate chart, so this is my O, this is my O prime. And that goes to a different r to the n. And I have coordinates x prime here. So then how you really define this function is that you say, well, I basically go from this r to the n to r. And so all you need to know is just to define how to define functions from r to the n to r. But if there is another map, at the same time, it must be true that the same number I have to get if I go from this other r to the n, so from x prime to r, and I have to get the same result. And of course, the result is just the value of the function at this point p, and you define it as f x of p. But if you have the other coordinate system, you can also define it as f x prime of p. So I'm just saying whatever I get going here has to be the same as going there if the definition actually makes sense. And so people write this as f of x equals to f prime of x prime. And this is, if you want, a transformation rule how the scalars transform under the coordinate change. Right? But it's really simply, so I want to define f of p in terms of my coordinates so that I can define my function as simply a function from r to the n to r, which I know how to do. Okay, and so this must be true then. Questions? All right, so now something more complicated. So this is the simplest object you can define on the manifold. An example would be Ricci scalar, as you will see it later, or it could be a temperature on the surface of the Earth, and stuff like that. So now, more complicated object is a tangent vector. And what's really complicated about it is that it doesn't really live on the manifold. It lives in its own space, which is called tangent vector space. And so very crudely, this is just a direction of a derivative at a point, direction of a derivative at a point. So first I will just define what a vector means at a point. So you take a point on the manifold, and then you are asking what is, how to define the corresponding vector. And then we will extend this to the whole manifold by discussing vector fields. Okay? So now what you do in R to the n, in your high school, typically thinking about vectors as simply a set of numbers, Vn. Of course, what it really means is that I measure these numbers with respect to some basis. So let's say in Cartesian coordinates, I say this is how far I go in the x direction, how far I go in the y direction, and so on. But equally, you can think about the vector as a differential operator. So differential operator, a directional derivative. And so you just write this differential operator as v hat. and you define it to be V mu d over dx mu. So that's another basic like one way. I have these numbers v1, v2, vn. So I just combine them with the corresponding derivative in that direction. And this is my differential operator, directional derivative. Okay? So I'm differentiating in the direction of the vector v. Okay, so now what is beautiful is that if you consider how this directional derivative acts on a function, so if you are at a point, I simply differentiate the function at that point in that direction, and I get a number, right? So if this is at a point, this simply gives me some number. If I consider many points, it gives me a new function, which is a derivative of the old function. But okay, so this is at a point. Okay, and so we know that this is a derivative. In order this to be a derivative, it has to satisfy two basic rules. It has to be linear, and it has to satisfy the Leibniz rule. So that's basically a definition of a derivative. If something is linear and something satisfies Leibniz rule, then you call the corresponding thing a derivative. So it's linear and obeys Leibniz rule. Okay, so this is what happens in R to the n. And the statement is that basically the same thing you can use as a definition to what you mean by a vector on the manifold. And so I will give you an abstract definition, but it's basically just, you know, trying to say that a vector is really can be understood as a differential operator. And in order this to be a nice differential operator, it has to be linear and satisfy Leibniz rule. So definition. So let scalar F be a collection of C infinity scalar functions. So this is just I have a set of scalar functions. Then you say that a tangent vector v at a point p is a map which maps my scalar functions at the point to some real numbers. Or if you extend it over the whole manifold, you would get another function. So that it is linear what I mean by that is that if my vector acts on a times f plus b times g, where a and b are real numbers and f and g are the functions, then you simply get it's a v on f plus b b on g. So this is a, b are real numbers, and f and g are the functions. That's what linearity means. And it obeys the Leibniz. And so if it acts on the product of two functions, f and g, simply given by f at p, v acting on g, plus g at p, v acting on f. Okay, and that's it. So this is it's a very, very abstract definition of a vector on a manifold, of a tangent vector of a manifold. It's simply a differential operator, if you want, which is linear and obeys the Leibniz rule. Okay, and so the definition makes sense. Question is, so in R to the n, you can see that it precisely corresponds to this directional derivative, which you can understand as a vector. So why not? Okay, and so nothing here would cause problems on the manifold, right? So I only need to know how to define the functions, and then I define this thing here, a map from functions to real numbers. So by the way, there is much less and more intuitive definition of a tangent vector that uses a curve. So basically, you define a tangent vector as something which behaves, which is like a tangent vector to a curve on the manifold. You already know how to define curves on the manifold, and then you know how to move along this curve, and you know whatever is pointing in the direction of the curve, then this will be my tangent vector. Then I say at a point I can have infinite number of curves, right? So I can have curves going this way or that way or that way, and so then I can have all these tangent vectors there, and they all form a tangent vector space. Okay, so this definition you will discuss in your tutorial on Monday, and it's maybe more intuitive. This is more abstract, but this is also actually simpler because you don't have to talk about curves or anything. All you require is the linearity and Leibniz rule. Okay, so now let's have some properties, and so I now want to discuss, you know, so this is a definition, and then to prove some of the things, yeah, it will take some time. So I would just formulate everything which I need as a theorem. Okay, so theorem. And some things are easy to show, some things are more difficult to show. But anyway, so the set of tangent vectors, tangent vectors at P forms a tangent vector space and is denoted by TPM. So M is the manifold, I am at the point P, and T stands for the tangent vector space. And so this TPM has the same dimensionality, as the manifold. As M. So if you have n-dimensional manifold, TPM will also be n-dimensional. And then you can form a basis in this tangent vector space. And I'll be, so you can choose any basis you want in the vector space, right? I can choose, well, some basis vectors, and they don't need to be orthogonal, they don't need to satisfy anything. They just have to be independent. And I have to have n of them. But actually, in general relativity, typically people start with the coordinate basis. That's really, I'm discussing if I have coordinates x and y, then I will have the coordinate basis dx, d over dx and d over dy, so in the direction of x and y. So with coordinate basis, d over dx mu. So I'm just using these local coordinates, x mu, which are valid in my neighborhood. But of course, what I'm really thinking about is this map psi to my r to the n. So then I have, well, I'm really thinking about these coordinates here, x mu. And then these are assigned the corresponding coordinate basis. OK, so that's the coordinate basis in my TPM. And then any vector. Vector v can be expressed as v equals to v mu d over dx mu. Okay. So this is my vector. This is an invariant object. Doesn't depend on which coordinates you choose to describe your neighborhood of the point P. These are the components of the vector, and this is the basis. Okay, so Let's have a picture. So to illustrate this, let us consider a sphere. So example, our manifold is a sphere S2. So this is S2. And let me choose some point P on that manifold. So then the statement is that this tangent vector space does not really live on that manifold, but it is a linear space, right? It is a vector space. So linear space cannot be curved. It has to be flat. Okay, so what it really is like a tangent plane to this point P. So this is my TP of S2. It's a tangent plane I just make. I have my curved manifold here, and then I make this distance here, and that's my tangent vector space. Okay, and then I have to choose some basis in this vector space, so some basic vectors there. And so let's say I have the coordinates theta and phi. So this is my coordinate theta, and this would be my coordinate phi. And they hopefully meet at the point P. Okay, and so then you would choose one vector to be d over d phi, and then another vector to be d over d theta. Okay, so that's my basis vectors. Of course, in this case, they are sort of orthogonal. So d over d phi points in this direction because that's my phi coordinate here, and d over d theta goes in that direction. And then, of course, I can express any vector, whatever the vector I have, B. I can just write it as a linear combination of this vector d over d theta and this vector d over d phi. So then I will just write V to be V theta d over d theta plus V phi d over d phi. And so this vector here, of course, is independent of the coordinates. So if I change coordinates from d over d theta to d over d phi to some local Cartesian coordinates, dx and dy, I can equally write it as vx d over dx plus vy d over dy. But the vector stays the same, right? It's completely independent of how I choose the coordinates there. Okay. Questions? Well, that would be an example of what's going on here. So now, let's do this more generally. So what I just did, let's say I change the coordinates. So what happens with my vector? So under a coordinate change, we have that in one coordinate system. So this is my vector, which is invariant object. And so I can write it in this basis, v mu x d over dx mu. So I'm using the coordinates x mu here. But after all, this is just a derivative, right? This is just, that's how we define it. It's a differential operator. It's a derivative. So now I can use the chain rule to change coordinates here. So this is equal to v mu in coordinates x. And then I use the chain rule dx prime nu dx mu d over dx prime nu. Just using the chain rule here. But if you look at this, then what stands in front of d over dx nu have to be components in my new coordinate basis. So this has to be b prime nu at x prime, so that I can write it b prime nu x prime d over d
x prime u. Okay? So, very good. So you see that you can also understand vectors. So first of all, vectors are invariant objects. They don't depend on the coordinates which you use. But the components of the vectors, they change under coordinate transformation. Okay? Because the basis actually changes. Okay? So we have the transformation rule that v prime nu of x prime is dx prime nu dx mu v mu of x. So these are the, this is the component change. So how component transforms, components transform. But beware that V itself is invariant object. So vector V is something which doesn't change, but its components do change and according to this formula. So you see that in order to really change coordinates for my vector, so I start with some components here, V mu and in some coordinate x. And then you have to do two things. First of all, you have to multiply these components by this transformation matrix. It's just some transformation matrix lambda nu mu, right? So I have to multiply these components by this transformation matrix lambda nu mu. But at the same time, I better evaluate the result in new coordinates, right? So you have to do two things. You have to multiply by the transformation matrix, but you also, whenever on the right-hand side you see x, you have to replace it with x prime. And so then you are done with your transformation. Of course, this reduces to if you have linear transformations, as in the Lorentz transformations, this will be our matrix lambda as we know it from Lorentz transformation. Questions? So who hasn't seen this? Everybody's seen it. Oh, some people. That's good. It's good. At least for some people, this is useful, hopefully. So now, whatever I was saying here is true at a point. So now you want to really define vectors over the whole manifold. In other words, so what we just did is that we define at this point, we define that this is my vector here, and that vector lives in its own space. But what you would like to do is that to extend the definition of this vector in the whole manifold. So then I have another point, another point, another point. And you would call, so this is how your vector changes. Of course, each of these vectors, they live in its own vector space. But you can use the differential structure of manifolds to say, well, if the map from these vectors, well, vectors acting on functions, it's like a real number at a point. But if I change points, it will be a function. And if this function is smooth, then I will call that a vector field on the manifold. So each vector here lives in a different space. But I have a way how to say, well, how to extend this to the overall manifold by saying that the function has to be smooth. OK, so definition. A tangent vector field, So here I'm trying to distinguish field from not field, but in the end I'll just be using them as the same thing. So I will say it's a vector. What I mean is probably it's a vector field. So a tangent vector field B is defined as a collection of these VP. So I know how to define a tangent vector at the point P. And then I just let it run for all P, which belong to my manifold M, such that if you take V on F, so previously we had this evaluated at a point and it was a real number, but now we let all these points vary through the manifold, so this is a function, so is a smooth function. Smooth function. Okay, and so that's what you mean by a vector field. So basically, you know, what it says is that if I am at this point here and my vector is pointing this direction, then if I am infinitesimally close to my point, the vector suddenly cannot be pointing completely different direction, right? Then it wouldn't be smooth, right? Unless it undergone this rotation smoothly. But if it's like a really, really nearby point, the vector wouldn't, the corresponding function wouldn't be smooth if they just point different directions. They have to be smoothly connected. Yes?
Is F a curve along which the vector points?
Say it again and more.
F.
F? So f is a function. So this must be true for any function f out of these collections of functions. And so I'm saying for any function f, this v acting on f, which is now a function because I let p run through the manifold, has to be a smooth function on the manifold again.
How are you comparing two vectors because they sat in different vector spaces, right?
Yeah.
What do you mean by their?
Right. Yeah. Okay, this is just an intuitive, what I'm trying to say. So this is a definition, right? So I'm just taking V of F to be a smooth function. Nobody can argue with this. It's a definition, right? But yeah, of course, I didn't explain how to compare, you know, one vector here with another vector there, because this vector lives in one space and that vector lives in another space. And, you know, in general, there is no way how you can compare the two spaces. Okay, and you'll see that this is a huge problem when you are trying to differentiate vectors, right? Because when you are trying to differentiate vectors, you have to compare the vector here. So if you are defining, okay, I'll discuss it in a minute. So let's leave it here, and we will see what's happening later. Okay, so then one more definition. So this is a tangent vector field, and then you can also form a tangent bundle. A tangent bundle, and you call it TM, the tangent bundle over the manifold, and it's simply a union over all points on the manifold of TPM. So this is really a collection of all the tangent vector spaces over the manifold. So now, in order to know what's happening here, so in order to know, you know, how the vector which lives in this tangent, how the vector field living in this tangent bundle looks like, of course, I have to first tell where actually on the manifold I am. So I have to specify the point P, and that point P will be specified by some coordinates x mu. Okay? And then I have to say what the components of the vector are, and so that will be mean nu. So TM has local coordinates. Which consists of both where I am on the manifold, so of x mu, which tells me, you know, the coordinates of my point P, but also, you know, what my components of the vector are. It's actually a 2n-dimensional space. So tangent bundle is a 2n-dimensional space. And of course, if you think about Lagrangian mechanics, this is precisely what you need to describe Lagrangian. Lagrangian is a function of the positions and of the velocity. So Lagrangian will be a function which lives on this tangent bundle of the manifold. Okay? So now you see the tangent bundle is really what I typically say it's a configuration space. Okay? So we have
well, not really. Sorry. So configuration space would be the manifold. But if you want to specify the state of the system, you also need to know the velocities. And so the state of the system will live on the tangent bundle here. All right, this is just a connection to classical mechanics. Are there any questions? So now we understand what vector is. So let's play and define a similar thing, which is called a covector or a one-form. So definition: a cotangent vector, or a one-form. You can have two forms, three forms, five forms. So one form means that you have one index only. Omega at P in M is a map. Omega from TPM, the real number. Okay, so what it means is that a one form is an object which at that point P eats a vector and produces a number. Right, so now you see that there is a very, very different object to whatever the vector is. So what vector is that vector is a map which basically eats a function and produces a number. So it eats functions, whereas this guy eats vectors and produces a number. Very different object. Okay. So now I'll be just similar to what I formulated the theorem. Let's just keep going and say, so one forms. Form a cotangent vector space . So surprisingly they also live in a linear space, in a vector space, and it's called cotangent vector space. And to distinguish it from the tangent vector space, you just put a little star here. Okay, so T star P of M. If we didn't put the star, it would just be a tangent vector space. But with the star, it's a cotangent vector space, TPM. And then, of course, it's a vector space, so it has to have its own basis as well. So again, I have to have some vectors which form my basis. And you can define this basis, again, the coordinate basis. So if I have some coordinates on the manifold, I have the corresponding basis here. I have the corresponding basis here for the vectors. And then you can also induce another basis for these covectors or for these forms. So with a coordinate basis, which of course is a different from d over dx mu because it's a different space. So this is now basis dx mu. It's like small d, like a differential. And so this new basis dx mu, which is defined, so with a coordinate basis dx mu defined as dx mu over d over dx nu equals to delta mu nu. So that's the definition of my coordinate basis in this new cotangent vector space. So now see what this means, right? So I'm saying these one forms simply eat vectors and produce a number. This guy here is a vector in my tangent space. D over dx nu is a basis of that vector space. So it's simply some nice vector in the tangent vector space. And this guy, I'm saying, well, it's a one form, right? So one form eats a vector and produces a number, right? And I define that this is a nice normalized thing. So only when they are the same,
you get one, and otherwise you get zero. Right? So this is precisely, you know, how what you would expect, right? So you see that you don't need, so sometimes people are confused, they think they need a metric for these things and stuff like that. It's nothing to do with this metric, right? So you have just simply two different objects. One object eats vectors, and that's a vector. The other object eats vectors and produces a number. It's a covector of one form, and everything is defined. So they live in their own spaces, and they are independent objects, and only their basis actually is inferred by requiring this requirement. Nothing to do with metric or anything else, right? All right, so now how a typical covector looks like, of course, I can expand a typical covector in the corresponding basis. So a covector omega can be written as omega mu dx mu. Again, this is my basis. And these are my components of the thing. And this object is an invariant object manifold. Okay. I can change the basis. I can change the coordinates. And that will change this basis here. So I can also write that this is omega mu of x. And then I use, well, it's not a chain rule, but almost a chain rule, how a differential transforms under coordinate change. And so this is dx mu over dx prime nu, dx prime nu. So now I require that this is omega prime nu, nu dx nu prime. And so you see that this thing here has to be omega prime nu. So we have a transformation rule for covectors, is that omega prime nu in my new basis, x prime, is dx mu over dx prime nu, omega mu at x. So again, omega is an invariant object, but its components, if you want, transform in this way under the change of coordinates. Okay. And so now if you compare to whatever we had for the vectors, that this transformation matrix is precisely the inverse of the transformation matrix for vectors. Right? So you can say that omega and V transform inversely because the corresponding matrices, transformation matrices, are inverse. This one and the one for the vector. Okay, so this was again at a point. So now you can extend that to the whole manifold. And again, you require smoothness. So a cotangent bundle, P star of M is a union over all P, P star M. And so my omega, which would be now a cotangent vector field or one-form vector field, is just a collection of these things through all points in the manifold. And so this thing will have local coordinates. Again, I have to say where on the manifold I am, but also what my components of the form are. Okay. So now if you had the name,
tangent or cotangent bundle are specific examples of fiber bundles. So something which extra structure which you build above your manifold, if you want. Okay. So now this is the object which is interesting for Hamiltonian mechanics, because you know that the phase space actually contains the information about the position and about the momentum. So now you remember that I was writing momentum is indexed down. Precisely this guy here, it has indexed down, which is a proof that this is good for your phase space description of Hamiltonian mechanics, right? Questions? Okay. So this is, I would say this is most difficult is to understand what a vector and what a covector is. But once you know that, you can easily extend to objects with more indices. So to tensors, like more general tensors. And basically, more general tensors, they behave like a product of these one forms and vectors. So in particular, their components transform in the corresponding way, where you transform each index separately. All right, so a tensor very vaguely, it's a product of forms and vectors. Product of forms and vectors. Okay. So now for more definition. Say you have a tensor of type K and L and rank K plus L. You just specify what K is, what L is, and then the rank is simply just sum of the two. Is a multilinear that means linear in each slot, multilinear map. So you have a tensor T of type K and L and rank K plus L is a multilinear map which eats some forms and vectors. So TP star times TP star. So it eats K forms, K1 forms, or K covectors. And it eats L vectors TP times TP and L times, and gives you a number if you are at a point. Okay, so simply, a tensor is something which likes to eat vectors and likes to eat forms, and then produces a number. And then, so this was at a point, and then you can again define a tensor field, which is just this extension of this thing to the whole manifold. Okay, so now, how you write a tensor? So example. I have type 2-1 tensor T. So the rank is 3. Rank 3 tensor. And so the statement is that this tells me how many vector-like indices I have, and this tells me how many one-form indices I have. And so this tensor T simply can be written as T alpha beta gamma, and then D over DX alpha
tensor product d over dx beta, tensor product dx gamma. Okay, so I'm just extending whatever I wrote before, where these are the components, and this is the basis. This is now the basis for 2-1 type tensors, and these are simply the components living in the basis here. Again, no indices are left in the end. This must be an invariant object on the manifold. All right, so what are the components? So the components are simply the tensor evaluated on the basis. Okay, so the component, similar to what we had before. So if you want, the components T alpha beta gamma are simply the tensor itself, which is a multilinear map which eats these vectors and forms. So it will eat a form dx alpha, it will eat a form dx beta, and it will eat a vector dx gamma. So if you evaluate your tensor on these basis vectors, this is my one form, this is another one form, and that's a vector, it gives you a number. That number you call T alpha beta, and it's the component of the tensor. Okay, so how you see that? Well, you have to write down what T is. So T is this object here. Okay, so let me just use different indices because, okay, so what is this? So this is T, and let's use different indices. So gamma, delta, iota, T over dx gamma times T over dx delta times dx iota. And the whole thing has to act on this dx alpha, dx beta, and d over dx gamma. Okay, so now how this works is that, of course, you know, whatever you feed in the first slot is related to this thing here. Whatever you eat in the second slot is related to the basis here, and this thing is related to the basis there. Okay, so now you have to get a number. So you use the definition of this coordinate basis here. So you are using always the fact that one form acting on a vector gives you this delta mu nu. So what you have to find is how dx alpha acts on d over dx gamma. Well, it gives you delta alpha gamma. So what is this? So this is equal to T gamma delta, and then iota. And then the first slot is simply dx alpha acting on my d over dx gamma, dx gamma. And then you have another slot, which is dx beta acting on d over dx delta. And then to get a number, I have to swap the two. So it will be dx iota acting on dx gamma. Okay, so this is delta alpha gamma. This is delta beta delta. And this is delta iota gamma. And so now I use this. And then you see that this is equal to T alpha beta gamma, as it should. Okay, so that's a proof that really the components are nothing else than the tensor evaluated on the corresponding coordinate basis. So what, you know, so people are used to work with tensors in terms of the components. What I would like you to do in Monday's tutorial to treat them more invariantly, to treat them, you know, to put the basis there as well, and just you know, do the calculations with the basis. And actually, often this is simpler than just doing the calculations with the components, especially when it comes to anti-symmetric tensors like forms. This is really, really simpler than just doing the component calculations. Because when you have the component calculations and you have anti-symmetric or symmetric tensors, you have to keep track of how many the same terms you have, or you know, when you do the symmetrization or anti-symmetrization, and it's a nightmare to keep track of the numbers. But if you keep the basis there, then everything actually comes out very simply. All right, so final word is that, of course, you can also think about the components, and the components simply transform under the change of basis as you would expect. So if you have t prime alpha, and then you have some other indices, and then mu of x prime, then this index transforms as a vector. So it's dx prime alpha over dx delta. And then this index transforms as a one form. So it's dx over dx mu prime dx kappa, and then t delta kappa of x. So you can also think about tensors as objects whose components transform in this way. However, I think it's much better to think about them as these multilinear maps and put the basis always there. All right. So now, from whatever the definition is here and whatever I'm doing here, it's obvious that you can form some nice operations with tensors. And so let's put a cookbook. If you want to fry eggs or whatever, then if you want to deal with tensors. So first of all, you can add tensors. If you have tensor T and tensor S, you can add them, provided they are of the same type. If of the same type, of course, if they are different types, I cannot do that, right? So if I have a scalar, I cannot add it to a vector. But if I have two vectors, I can add them together to get another vector. Okay. Then you can make bigger tensors by the tensor product. Tensor product makes bigger tensors, makes bigger tensors. So simply, you write these tensors. So I want to make a product of t times s. So whatever my t was, if I write it with the components and the basis, and whatever the s was in the components and the basis, and then you just simply put the components together, but leave the whatever the basis is there with now the new tensor product. So you're just creating a bigger tensor with bigger basis. And more components. Okay. You can contract tensors. Contract. So to make them smaller objects, smaller. So how it works is that if you have, for example, our example here, you have T alpha. You have the 2-1 rank tensor, d alpha beta, d over dx alpha, d over dx beta, dx gamma. So you see that you have slots, which are some slots are up and some slots are down. So now I can say I can contract, let's say, the index alpha and gamma. So what it means is that I decide that my basis vector dx gamma actually acts on my basis vector d over dx alpha. It produces a number, delta gamma alpha. Right, and so then in the end, if I do this contraction in the first and the third slot, I get something which has only index beta. Okay, so in that example, I do t, and I contract the first index. I leave this one here, and then I contract the third index here. And so what it means, oh no, I really need that, is that you have this t alpha beta gamma, but now you act with your dx gamma on t over dx alpha, and then you leave the rest t over dx beta untouched. Okay, so this gives you delta gamma alpha, delta gamma alpha. And so in the end, what you have is t alpha beta alpha d over dx beta. So you see that this thing actually is a vector now. Let's call it v beta, which is the contraction of the tensor t alpha beta gamma in the first and third slot. So you are making objects smaller. Again, notice that you don't need any metric here. You are not doing anything with the metric, right? So we are just contracting. If you have one index up and one index down, you can always contract it. Of course, you can equally contract this guy with that guy. You get a different vector. Okay. The same thing happens if you have two tensors. So I can make their tensor product, and then I can contract some of the indices, make them smaller. Okay, so that's what contraction is. Finally, a trivial statement, tensor is an invariant object. It doesn't depend on coordinates. Okay. So then if you find that the tensor vanishes in one coordinate system, well, then the tensor is zero. So it must vanish in any other coordinate system. Right? And so this is something which sounds really trivial, but actually gives you lots of computational advantages. So if it's enough to show, you know, if you want to show some identity equals to zero, it's enough to show this identity in one coordinate system, and then you know because it's a tensor, it will be zero everywhere. Questions, comments? So everybody seen tensors before in this way? Somebody hasn't seen tensors? All right. So I would ask those who have seen tensors before, please discuss with the colleagues who haven't seen them before so that we are all on the same page and we can use them. Okay, so now we have the tensors. So we, of course, the metric will be just a special tensor and so on. But now we want to formulate the field equations for the metric. So we need to be able to differentiate these objects. So part C, the object which will allow us to differentiate vectors and covectors and tensors is called the connection.
Is there an analog of the cotangent bundle and tangent bundle for tensors? Or?
It would just be a product.
A product.
Yeah. So tensors are basically like product of vectors and covectors. Yeah. Okay. So we want differential equations. For tensors. So we need to be able to differentiate tensors. So now if you have a function, recall that for a function, you define the derivative of that function. Let's say this is just function of one variable t. At point t0, you just define it to be f t0 plus s plus minus f at t0 divided by s, and you take the limit as goes to 0. Okay, so this is how you define a derivative of a normal function. So now you see that it's really a problem for the vectors, right? So if I want to define similar way a derivative of a vector,
then I'm deeply in trouble, because what does it mean? So okay, so T0 I can replace is the point on the manifold P, and then I would say, well, this plus S is P plus delta P minus F of P. But you know, what does it mean, P plus delta P, right? So how do I move in the manifold? How do I recognize where my delta P is? That's first problem. So problems. First, where is delta P? Oh, how do I do P plus delta P, the manifold? So that's the first problem. And then the second problem, of course, if you have a vector, is that how to compare V at P plus delta P with V at P. And the reason is simple, because they live in a different space. If I had P and I somehow had P plus delta P here, then this vector lives here, and that vector lives in a different tangent space. And how do I identify these tangent spaces, right? How do I, so can I really say they are the same tangent vector space and then compare them somehow? Can I? Answer?
No.
No, that's a good answer. So this cannot be done in general, cannot be done. Cannot be done. In general, and the statement is that in order to do it, in order to identify the tangent space in one point with another tangent space in another point, you need an extra structure in the manifold. So cannot be done in general unless extra structure exists in the manifold. This is very vague, so let's be concrete. Or you know, unless something additional happens, right? Something nice and which allows me to compare whatever is here, whatever is there. So, people typically consider three possibilities, each of which is very, very interesting and important. And so you have like three different derivatives on the manifold. But for some of them, you need this extra structure on the manifold, and some of them only work for special tensors on the manifold. Not for all the tensors on the manifold, but only for special tensors. Okay, so you have three standard possibilities. So by far the simplest one is the one which we are not going to discuss at all, and that's the Lie derivative. Okay, that's the simplest whatever you can do ever on the manifold to differentiate things. And in order to write down the Lie derivative, all you need is a vector field on the manifold. So need a vector field U on the manifold. Once you have that vector field U on the manifold, of course, this vector field penetrates the whole manifold. And it tells me, can I travel from P to delta P or not? If P and delta P, well, I can. If, you know, I can travel along this vector field here, right? So then it tells me how to go from P to delta P. It's simply, you know, just go along this integral curve of the vector field U. Okay, so it tells me that. But of course, I can also drag my tangent vector space with me along this vector field. So I can actually sort of gradually move this one to here, and then I can compare whatever. So once I move this one to that one, I can compare whatever I see there. Okay, so this is the simplest by far derivative. All you need is a vector field on the manifold, and then you simply drag things along this vector field, and you define what it means, p plus delta p, and how to compare the tangent spaces. Okay, if you want to know more, you can study the appendix of the study text, or you can wait till gravitational physics course in January, where this will be discussed. Second possibility, so this is really the simplest one. Simplest and nicest and best for everything and whatever. So then you have exterior derivative. This one does not need any additional structure, but it doesn't work for tensors in general. It only works for special tensors, works only for forms which are completely antisymmetric tensors. So if you have a tensor which is completely antisymmetric in all indices, for example, Levi-Civita pseudotensor, then there's a way how to define a derivative of such object, and you don't need any additional structure for that. Okay, so this is again beautiful possibility, but it only works for some things, and unfortunately, it's not good for relativity. We need to differentiate objects which are not antisymmetric. We need to differentiate the metric and so on. That's not antisymmetric, so this will not help us. Okay, so finally, and by far the most ugly and disgusting possibility is the covariant derivative. And it's really the most complicated one, if you want. So why is it more is the most complicated is that the extra structure which you need is a connection. Need connection. Let's call it gamma, which is a really sneaky object. Okay, so that's the. First of all, it's complicated. It has three indices. Second of all, it's not a tensor. It's a very strange object. And the covariant derivative is really, really ugly. Unfortunately, that's precisely what you need for general relativity. So we have to discuss this possibility, although it's definitely the most ugly one out of these three. Okay, so let me just concentrate on this. And let me do it like in a pedestrian way. So we concentrate on possibility three, and we make an observation that if you have a scalar function phi, and you just take a partial derivative of this and consider d mu phi, then this thing actually transforms as 0, 1 tensor. Okay, you can easily check that. So you just change the basis, you change the coordinates from x mu to x mu prime, and you find that this object really transforms as an object omega mu is supposed to transform. And so really, out of a scalar, you can form a one form, which is a nice tensor, by just taking a partial derivative here. So this is fine. I can take a partial derivative of a scalar, and I get a tensor. So now, you would like this to be true also for, let's say, a vector. If I take the corresponding derivative of a vector, this better behaves like a 1-1 tensor, okay? So let's have a look at that. So let's try with the partial derivative. To take a partial derivative of, so d mu v nu. Is this a 1-1 tensor? if it is, then we can claim the victory. And so just taking a partial derivative produces a tensor out of a tensor, and this is what we want. So if you look at how this thing looks like in new coordinates, so you have d mu prime v prime alpha x prime. Well, so what it is d over dx prime mu on, now I use the transformation rule for a vector. So it's dx prime alpha dx nu v nu. Okay. So I'm just writing what it is using the transformation rule of a vector. And so you differentiate this and you have two terms using the Leibniz rule. And I'll also use the chain rule to write them in a more complicated way. But you'll see that's precisely just these two terms. All right. So you can write this as dx prime alpha dx nu dx nu dx beta dx prime mu d, okay, v nu beta. So that's if I differentiate by vector v with respect to x prime mu. D over dx beta is here, dx beta over dx prime mu. Plus the second term, which is dx beta dx prime mu d square x prime alpha dx beta dx nu v nu. So that's the second term if I differentiate this transformation matrix. So now you look at this expression here and you see I have an object v nu beta. And so this is a transformation matrix, how the new index should transform. And this is a transformation matrix, how my beta index should transform. And so this is fine. This is precisely how. So this is OK. OK, because it transforms like 1-1 tensor. OK. This will be the corresponding transformation of a 1-1 tensor. However, I have also this ugly term here. And this is not what you need for a transformation of it. So this is a problem. And so it's precisely this term which spoils the fact that the partial derivative of a vector does not transform as a 1-1 tensor. Okay? So this is the problem. So by the way, notice that if you are back to special relativity and you are only allowed to do Lorentz transformations, Lorentz transformations are linear. Okay? So then here I'm differentiating twice with respect to x. And so the first differentiating just gives me a constant and the second one gives me a zero. So this term will not be there if you just consider Lorentz transformations. So what you just proved is that the partial derivative of a vector is a 1-1 tensor in special relativity. But it will not be for general coordinate transformation because this term in general will be here. Okay? So now how to deal with this thing? And here comes Riemann and his PhD in 1830. So to deal with this, there's this. And that's Riemann 1830. Is this, he says, well, okay, so the partial derivative of a vector does not transform nice, so I better add something which cancels this problematic term. And so he proposes to do a covariant derivative to a covariant derivative and simply write, instead of partial mu, you write nabla mu v nu, and that will be given by the partial one plus something which cancels this problematic term, and let's call it gamma nu mu alpha v alpha. Okay, that's fine. Okay, so now you require that this thing behaves as a 1-1 tensor. And in order this to behave as a 1-1 tensor, you have to impose some transformation properties of this symbol gamma. Okay, so gamma is called connection. And in order this to transform as a 1-1 tensor, the connection has to transform the following way. Has to transform as, so now I write it in the new coordinates, gamma prime, alpha, beta, gamma. So now we have the tensorial part. Dx prime alpha dx kappa dx delta dx prime beta dx delta dx prime gamma kappa delta iota. So this would be the tensorial part. This is how a tensor of rank 3 would transform. However, that would not help us, because if this thing transforms as a tensor, this transforms as a tensor, but this does not, so this will not. Okay, so then I have to actually cancel that problematic term, and so this is done by minus d square x prime alpha dx kappa dx delta dx kappa dx prime beta dx delta dx prime gamma. Okay, so I'm just adding this term. You see I have a term which has two derivatives here, and precisely if you just plug it here, that will cancel this term over here. So basically what you do is that you say, well, I can upgrade my partial derivative by adding some extra term. But this extra term, because this doesn't transform as a tensor, this extra term cannot transform as a tensor. And I just find how that object has to transform so that the result, the sum, actually transforms as a tensor. All right. So now you can. So this is for the vector. So now you may be worried that if I have a covector, I will have to introduce another object, but it's actually not so. The same gamma will do the trick, but now the transformation is with a minus sign. Well, the upgrade is with a minus sign. So for a covector, what you require is that nabla alpha omega beta transforms as a 0-2 tensor. So you want this to be 0-2. And then you can easily show that this can be, again, given by the partial derivative, but now minus gamma alpha beta omega gamma. Okay, and so this object, again, this is the same gamma as we have for the vector, will transform as a 0-2 tensor. All right, and similarly, you can do with objects with more indices. If you have a tensor which has more indices, some indices up and some indices down, then the covariant derivative of an object will be simply given by the partial derivative minus the terms for each index down, and then plus the term for each index up. And this is how we do covariant derivative. And the covariant derivative produces tensors out of tensors, simply adding one more index to your object. And it's a tensor. Questions? Yes?
How are you defining the partial derivative of a vector or a covector?
Oh, you just take the, yeah. So this is in components, right? So I just take the components and I just differentiate them with respect to the coordinates.
Okay, because components are functions, right?
Cool. Components is something, right? Special. So yeah, it's some concrete expression.
Having the problem that nearby points, I mean, that tangent vectors are inside on different spaces.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, yeah. No. So So here I'm just saying, you can just do normal partial derivative in components, but this thing will not do the trick. I have to upgrade it in order to have something covariant, in order to have a new tensor. So if the resulting object is not a tensor, of course, this will depend on the coordinates, right? So in one coordinate system, it will be zero, and in another coordinate system, it won't be zero. Right? So then it's a disaster. I cannot write down any field equations because it's not a tensor equation. But yeah. So really, this thing somehow solves the problem how to move from P to delta P. So the correction sort of tells you how to compare these tangent spaces. OK, so one final note I want to say. If you look at this gamma alpha beta, how it transforms, it has the nice part, is the tensorial part, plus the ugly part. OK, so now you may be thinking, well, so this is not a tensor for sure. But if you subtract two connections, and you antisymmetrize in the indices. So you say, I take gamma alpha gamma beta minus gamma alpha beta gamma. So you just take antisymmetrization in the lower two indices. Then this thing actually is a tensor. And let's call it T alpha beta gamma, and this is a tensor, and it's called torsion. Torsion. So you can check that, you know. So you can now see, you know, how this object transforms, and how that object transforms. You subtract the two. And what remains is the tensorial part, and this part will cancel with that part. Okay, and so you have an interesting tensor formed out of a connection, and so this tensor doesn't really play any role in general relativity, but plays a role in its generalizations, like various supergravities and stuff like that. And we will not really discuss it, but in the same way as we will see that an energy tensor is a source of your metric, then you would say that a spin energy tensor, so if you have some particles with spin, they are a source of torsion. Okay, so whenever you have particles with spin, fermions, and whatever, then actually you will have also non-trivial torsion in your space-time. And of course, in string theory, you have fermions, and you have lots of bosons and lots of fermions all the time, and that's why actually the torsion plays a really important role for string theory. So, yeah. All right, questions? Let me just stress that in these considerations, again, metric did not play any role. So we haven't used metric until now whatsoever. All we have been doing today is just without a metric. Once you have a metric, you can actually write very nice connection. So any object which satisfies the transformation rule is a connection, but you can write very, very nice connection if you have metric. OK, and we will do it tomorrow. Questions? All right. See you in the afternoon.